from those members of the committee who are here, and we are expecting a few more. We do have 3 confirmed absences today, but we are expecting a few more to come in. So I'd like to welcome all of you here. Just a note to our committee persons who are here. We'd like you to make sure you fill out your per diem forms with the price of gasoline, although I doubt I had to remind you of that. The order of the agenda today, just want to make sure everyone knows, we'll be doing the PERS issue from 10 until noon, State Fair at 1:15, and building codes at 2 o'clock today. As we begin, I'd like to restate another time why we are involved in the PERS issue. And Senate Bill 722, as all of you know, failed last session. That is a bill that, according to thought at the time, would ease the financial burden on local governments and public employers, caused primarily by a couple of issues. The passage of House Bill 3349 back in 1995, that was the legislature's answer to the Supreme Court ruling, compensating state retirees whose benefits, according to the court, had been unfairly taxed. Also, the bill is also brought about, was also brought about to deal with the mismatch that was occurring with the money market retirement calculation. There is an unfunded problem here, and we're trying to get to the bottom of it. We were asked to undertake this issue to try to see if there are any inherent difficulties or malfunctions within the system, try to identify those if there are those. And since we have been given that mandate to look this over, a number of things have happened on the PERS board that addressed a number of the things in 722. So as we move along today, we're going to get an update on that from PERS staff and find out what has gone on with respect to those issues and those things that will tend to remediate the difficulty that has been perceived with this entire system. So with that, I'd like to introduce our first guest today, and I'd like to have Jim Poitko come up, David Bailey, and anyone else with PERS who would like to come up today. Jim is the new PERS Executive Director, and so we will allow him to introduce himself, and welcome.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and representatives. I am new. I've been on the job now for a period of time measured by days, not hours, which I appreciate. I'm here with David Bailey, the Deputy Director of PERS. We also have with us Mark Johnson, who's the PERS actuary, and also accompanying us and prepared to help us answer questions that you might have are Dale Orr, the Chief Financial Officer of PERS, and Steve Delaney, our Government Relations Manager. Our understanding is that your interest specifically today with respect to PERS is the issue of employer rates. And we're going to focus our discussion on the system's unfunded liability and the employers, types of employers that are affected. But as importantly, going through the history of how we've gotten to this point, we want to stress that the board and the staff have been working with all of the affected parties to figure out solutions. And as the chairman mentioned, the board has taken a number of steps to address this issue as part of the PERS system. I want to turn the discussion over to the Deputy Director, David Bailey, to discuss the key factors that have been driving the recent employer rate increases and to recount for you in as much detail as you'd like the steps that the board has been taking to address each of them. And then we'll talk about a few more initiatives that we're about to launch that I think are targeted specifically to this issue. So I'll turn the discussion over to David.
Thank you, Jim, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm first going to talk about, as I believe we were requested to talk about, the scope of the problem. And I think you all have a copy of the outline that we're going to follow today. When my assistant copied these this morning, she came back and said, it appears that the scope of the problem is David Bailey. And I don't think that's the case. I'm here to try and tell you what it is. I'm trying to be part of the solution, not part of the problem. Essentially, the problem on an ongoing basis is that due to the high earnings of the fund, we have a number of employers who, in fact, all employers must now match the earnings of their employees. And that's a change that has occurred from the way the system has operated in the past. We've always, assess the liabilities, future liabilities of the system, assuming that people would retire under a formula benefit based on their years of service and their final average salary. And now, within the last 2 years, with very high earnings in the fund, we have become a system where about 95% of the current members are going to retire under the money match. And that's a calculation where we take the account of the member, which is generated by their 6% of salary contributions plus earnings throughout their career. The employer matches that amount, and then we annuitize it for the expected life expectancy of the member. Under that situation, the employers must have a matching amount in their accounts, and some, a small number, do not. Of our 426 local government employers, about 50 or so do not have the funds equal to the funds that their employees have, and that's a potential ongoing problem. For them, higher earnings in the fund, as we've seen in the last couple of years, are going to have the tendency of driving up their rate, and there's additional things that need to be done to address that problem. Other employers have also seen their rates go up, even though they have accounts that are greater than the value of their employees. And for most of them, the biggest increase was due to House Bill 3349, as the chairman mentioned. That, if you look on a system-wide basis, accounted for almost a 2% average increase in rates, 2% of payroll following the 97 valuation. I misspoke a little bit. The average increase system-wide was almost 2%. Of that amount, 1.4% was due to House Bill 3349. So a big piece of the average increase was due to House Bill 3349. Without 3349, all the state agencies in the state pool would have seen their rate go down. And without 3349, all the school districts' rates would have remained about the same. However, the high earnings of the last 2 years, 1998 and 1999, should tend to lower rates for these employers because they have a higher amount of balance in their accounts as compared to the employees. I do need to say, though, that what will actually happen as a result of the 98 valuation is unpredictable at this point. We're very hopeful that we're going to see improvement for the majority of our employers, but there's a huge variety of factors that go into determining the results, and that's why we retain Mr. Johnson and they do a lot of work to determine what the rates are going to be in the following few years. Turning to the question of how the rate issue developed, use of the money match, as I mentioned, skyrocketed. We had in 1996 a earnings distribution of 21%, which was the highest distribution ever for the system. The following year, 1997, we had an earnings distribution of 18.7%, which was the second highest earnings distribution ever. So the two highest distributions ever, and they occurred back to back. In addition, we had House Bill 3349. That was a almost 10% benefit increase for retirees, and it was about a $1.3 billion additional liability for the PERS fund. And that has to be paid off over about 30 years. In addition to that, we did have some employers, and this I'm focusing again on those 50 or so that we still have an ongoing problem. They had actuarial experience not matching our predictions. And when you do actuarial assumptions for a state pool or for the school district pool, it's much easier to have the experience of the pool match your predictions. But when you're providing individual rates, which is what we do for all the 426 local governments, you're always going to have some that don't accurately fit the assumptions that you've made for the system. And we did have some that got pretty far afield. and that harmed them and hurt their rates. So we also had some methods of the system that we've used for many years, credit interest, which in the new money match area are harmful to employers. And one of those was participation in the variable. Statute allows employees to put up to 75% of the contributions made to their accounts into the variable fund. There's nothing in statute that ever mentioned employer participation in the variable. And so we've always had all the employer funds in the regular account. Well, over the last several years, with the huge earnings in the stock market, employers have tended to fall behind because of their employees' participation in the variable. Another area was the crediting of interest at the date of retirement. We've always credited interest to the employee through the date of retirement. If they retire on July 1, they'd get 6 months of earnings for that year. We wait to credit on the transfers from employers' accounts until the end of the year. And that has been a harm to employers as well. So we've looked at that. What actions has the board taken to address the issue? And I have provided, we've provided you a background that goes into this in a little bit more detail. But there's just a few areas where the board has taken some action. One is the variable participation by employers. And this is new since your last meeting. At the February meeting of the PERS board, the board mandated the participation of all employers in variable to the exact dollar amount that their employees participate. And the result of that will be that employers' liabilities will track now with the employees' liabilities. As employees' accounts go up, employers' accounts will go up. If employees' accounts go down, the employers' accounts will go down as well. One of the issues that the board discussed was when they would implement this, and they chose to implement it for 1999 earnings. And as a result of doing that, there's about an additional $115 million that was credited to employers' accounts as a result of that action. I talked about mid-year crediting of interest at the date of retirement. The board also made a change in that rule, and we now credit to employer accounts at the same time that we credit to employee accounts. And the net increase in distributions to employers for 1999 as a result of that was about $68 million. We also, working with the actuary, changed the actuarial assumptions on which we estimate the liabilities of the fund to recognize that we are now a money match dominated system. And that had the tendency of increasing rates. But if we waited and did it later, then it would increase rates even more in the future. So it was time to do that. As a result of these actions, the vast majority of our employers should see relatively stable rates going forward. And that includes all the state agencies, which are all included in the state agency pool, includes all the school districts, included in the school district pool. It includes the vast majority of the local governments. About 320 some now have, with these adjustments and the fact that they have more dollars in their accounts than their employees do, we should see stable rates going forward for them. And in fact, high earnings, higher than 8%, should tend to lower their rates. Now, there's a lot of factors involved, but all other things being equal, the rate should go down as a result of higher earnings. And we know that since the last valuation in 1998, we had an earnings distribution of 14.1%. And it looks like for 99, it's going to be around 18%. So we're very hopeful, I should say, that rates will be positively affected by the earnings of the last couple of years. Now that's for the majority of employers. For this other group that is not that has this mismatch in their funding as compared to their employees. The opposite is true. Higher earnings should tend to increase their rates. And so they have a potential ongoing problem. There's two areas that the board is looking at to assist with this. And one is the pooling of local government employers. We had an ad hoc committee of employers and union representatives working collaboratively on this issue. We do have a draft rule that it hasn't been approved by the board yet, but we are going to be going out and talking to our employers about that. And I think towards the end of the year, we'll come back to the board and we'll hopefully come forward with some kind of a pooling rule that will assist employers. The other area is bonding, working to find some way to facilitate borrowing of funds so that local governments, if they wish, can pay off their PERS liability. And that's something we need to do a lot more work on. And we've had a couple of employers do that already, City of Portland and Multnomah County. And they did it at a time when the rates were acceptable. The rates for bonds have gone up since then, and so it's not as economically feasible as it was at one time. But there are still probably some good reasons that some employers would like to bond, and so we may be coming to the legislature this year with a proposal, or some entity, I think, will be coming forward with a proposal on bonding, and we will work with them on that. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Voitko. Answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Let's hold on for just a moment. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you tell me how the pooling, Mr. Bailey, how this pooling might work?
Well, just in basic terms, the key to it is that we're not going to pool all the liabilities that currently exist for all the local government employers. We would set what some have called a firewall, and that date right now is in the draft is December 31, 2000. And before that date, all your employer liabilities would still be associated with this each employer. After that date, we would pool all future liabilities. And this is to address the concern of many employers that they don't want to be paying or having their taxpayers pay for the liabilities of other entities. And that's the key to it. Now, we've discussed whether it should be mandatory or whether it should be voluntary. And right now, the way it's drafted is it's voluntary. And we think there's a possibility that employers who are underfunded obviously would want to join the pool, but some that are overfunded would also want to join the pool. One of the reasons for that is that today we have there's a 6% minimum contribution by employers. We don't allow them to go below that. When we pool, we would allow some of the employers to go below that, and there's a number of employers that would have a lower rate as a result of joining the pool because they have a rate lower than 6%.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I believe, David, correct me if I'm wrong, that the majority of members in the PERS system are in large pools, correct?
All the state agencies, all the school districts.
So it's really the local employers that are non-pooled. So in some respect, the proposal that we're trying to develop asks the question, should we take those members that work for individual local employers that are treated in smaller boxes according to their individual employer now, unlike the rest of the system, say, should they be considered going forward as another pool like state workers and like teachers? The problem is, of course, not all of them are on the same footing as they stand on the threshold of entering that pool. Some of them have unfunded liabilities, and some of them don't. And so what David alluded to, the firewall, is saying, let's draw a line, and if you have unfunded liabilities in the past, you're still responsible for them as an individual employer. But going forward, you'll be treated like other members in the pool, and that is on a larger pooled basis. So this line in the sand is very important in terms of understanding how things would work going forward, but also making sure that past problems were identified and taken account on a separate, on a separate lens, if you will.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This pooling would be strictly voluntary, though, the way you're devising the program. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, yeah. Right now, the draft is voluntary. I think the board has to make a decision later in the year as to whether they think that's feasible. If we don't have enough employers participating in the pool, then it's not going to achieve what it's intended to achieve.
Representative Loken.
Thank you. I am looking at a memorandum here from Kent Squire, general manager of our Oak Lodge Sanitary District, which lies in my district. And they're very concerned that this be the administrative rule endorsed voluntary participation. This is a small local pool, local organization, but it is a very great concern to them. So, and also, I believe he has a good statement here in saying that he believes that meetings with local employers to discuss this very significant issue are mandatory, not an option. Mm-hmm. And I would certainly endorse that as well.
I may take you back to bonding for just a moment. Upon whose rating would these bonds be issued?
Mr. Chair, probably a little out of my area, but I think that's one of the key questions that has to be determined. It's very difficult. The smaller the entity, the more difficult it is to get a good rate and get any interest in even the sale of those bonds. So you may want to look at combining entities to have a viable bond issue.
Okay, thank you. Further questions? Proceed.
Thank you. Harking back to David's comments about the process that has taken place, I would say a couple things to close. One is that as we look at these various problems and address them, we've tried to start from a philosophy that says, unless statute otherwise directs us to do so, or unless there's some meritorious reason that suggests it would threaten the financial viability of the system as a whole for all of its members and interested parties, that we should start with the philosophy that says we should treat dollars equally, whether they come from employees or employers, again, unless otherwise directed by statute. And, so the burden of proof to us, even in our internal arguments, is why we should do anything differently. And it ties back to the question of treating with variable earnings returns the employer's money that goes against the employee's money that employee has designated as being treated on the variable basis. So there's this sense of parallel treatment that we've tried to develop that we think makes a lot of sense. The second thing is with regard to David's comment about our hopes, and believe me, I share it, that rates will be stable going forward. As David mentioned, it's not a guarantee. We'll only know for sure when all of the factors that go into the valuation that will be available later this year are taken into account. But it is our hope. It's the direction that we believe these things are pointing us toward. The last thing I'd like to mention is that we're doing two other things that you might want to know about. The first is that we do plan one of our periodic audits of our actuary, Milliman and Robertson. And we're already in the RFP stage. That's going forward. And I think that it's important because with so much at stake in the system, I think any thing that we can do to indicate the integrity of the numbers that come out of the system and to build trust that the numbers that people have to work with, including employers that are under financial stress, is the highest that we can give them. The second thing is that we're not going to wait for employers who have problems or who don't understand how the system is impacting their local finances to come to us to ask us questions. We plan an outreach program between April and July of this year that's going to be extremely extensive. In fact, we've already polled, what's the number of total employers that we've polled in our survey?
426.
426, and we've gotten a substantial number of replies. And we will be holding regional meetings with them. And if they so request, and we can possibly do it, we're going to hold individual meetings with them to discuss their specific situation. So we're going to do everything we can in the time allotted to give them an opportunity to talk about their problem with PERS staff itself. With that, I will I'll end my comments and thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Sure, thank you. Any further questions? Representative Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question. It's your understanding that you do not need legislative need legislation in order to go forward with your plan to parallel the variable account?
David, why don't you bring the representative up to date on the status of the rule? And
Mr. Chair, Representative Winters, that is correct. We've had extensive conversations with our attorneys, and they're in agreement that the board has the authority to take the action that it did. And we did, you'll probably recall, come to the legislature last time with a request for the authority. That was on the recommendation of our attorneys that it would be more clear if we had express authority from the legislature. But in the absence of that, we're still confident that we're on good solid legal ground.
Thank you. I wanted to ask you, too, about lump sum employer payout and also briefly about the contingency reserve. I see from your publication here that the PERS board does not have the authority to approve the lump sum employer payout. Could you tell me what effect that would essentially have on stabilizing this if adopted?
Mr. Chair, by lump sum employer payout, I'm not sure what you're referring to. I apologize. Maybe Mark
does. Yeah. Mark Johnson, Norman and Robertson. What you're referring to, Representative Wilson, is an option that would be made available to members at retirement. Currently, they have the option of withdrawing their own contributions in a single sum and receiving monthly payment that's funded by the employer. This proposal would allow members to withdraw twice their account balance. In other words, their entire, not only their entire amount, but a matching amount from the employer. The purpose of this would give employees more flexibility in terms of portability. They could take everything out with them. It would only be available after the employee meets the eligibility requirements for early retirement. So it's not the 35-year-old with 5 years of service getting double their account. It's only at retirement. Your specific question was, how does this affect stabilizing the funding of the system? There's actually a savings to employers if this were to occur, because the employer is obligated to fund the automatic 2% cost of living adjustment. And to the extent that a member elects to take out twice their account balance, there would be no future cost of living for that individual. Right now, when a member takes their own money in a refund, obviously the cost of living liability is cut in half with the money match. That is already factored into the rates. We already have an assumption about the probability of members taking out their own money. It happens to be about 15% of the members reaching retirement do take out their own money in a lump sum. If all of those 15% elected to take this double lump sum, the savings to employers would be about 0.4% on average. So, and you know, it sounds small, but that's a lot of money. And it's a huge payroll, over $5 billion payroll system-wide, so that translates to a lot of money. So in terms of stabilizing funding, it would actually lower employers' obligations because they wouldn't have to fund the 2% cost of living.
Right. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, just to add to that, that's something that we cannot do without a change in statute.
About the contingency reserve, where do we stand with that? I see you've been making some news with that as of late. Could you tell me what the status is of that? And I would imagine some others here will have something to say about that today, too.
Mr. Chair, again, we've spent a lot of time with our attorneys talking about the contingency reserve. The statute says that PERS will maintain a contingency reserve, and it also says the PERS board will determine the funding level of that reserve. Apparently there was a reserve at some time and they've eliminated that for the last several years. In our most recent discussions with the attorneys, we don't see any way that a contingency reserve, even though we, if we were to create one, we don't see any way that we could use that to assist employers. Our reading of it is that it's for the payment of benefits, and that's not what this problem is all about. So our belief, working with the Attorney General's office, is that the contingency reserve is not something that we can use to address this problem. Okay. Now, we have had indications that and we are being sued by Lane County and City of Eugene and EWEB. We've had indications from them that that might be one of the things that they want the court to determine. But the most recent thing on those suits is that the judge has given those entities 30 days to refine their complaint. Mm-hmm. And that was 10 or 15 days ago. So within a couple of weeks, we should have a better idea of what their claims are going to be.
Thank you. Further questions? All right, thanks very much. We may call you back up a little bit later. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next up, we'll have Maria Keltner, please. Morning.
Good morning. My name is Maria Keltner. I represent the League of Oregon Cities and Association of Oregon Counties. And being handed out to you, because today's topic was unfunded actuarial liability predominantly, I went through the list from the December 31st, 97 valuation and prepared the status of each county in 95 and 97, whether they were unfunded or had a surplus and how much, and each city, the same kind of information. On the front page of what Kara is giving to you, it indicates that there are 184 cities who participate in PERS. 60 of them have an unfunded liability, and 124 of them have a surplus, and it gives the figures. Of the counties, there are 34 counties. One of them has two accounts, so the accounts don't come out exactly even. 22 of those 34 counties have an unfunded liability, and 13 have a surplus. In what we refer to as the local entities, the other local entities, out of the 261, 118 have unfunded liabilities, and 143 have a surplus. When you summarize, we've got 200 city, county, and local employers with PERS accounts, 200 with unfunded liability, and 280 with surplus. And again, the figures are there. And the state and community colleges, which are in a pool, have an unfunded liability, which is approximately 23% of payroll, according to the actuarial valuation in 12/31/97. And the schools, who are in one pool, have an unfunded liability that's approximately 52% of payroll. Trying to get to the issue that came up at the last session, which is, how many of these employers are really in trouble with their unfunded liabilities? And hearing that there was a 50-employer number, I just sort of arbitrarily looked at the actuarial sheets that the employers received from this valuation and arbitrarily went through, I may have missed one or two because I did this in a hurry, to see how many of the local employers had an unfunded liability that was more than 100% of their payroll. And I listed those. On that first page also.
Just clarification.
Representative Hansen.
Maria, when you're saying percent of payroll, is that annual payroll or what?
I will be willing to be corrected by the PERS staff, but my understanding of that figure on that valuation sheet is that it's the 97 payroll? I don't know. That's more.
What's the payroll and the valuation?
Yeah. So the figure at the bottom of that sheet says UAL is a percent of payroll. That's the 97 payroll. Okay, so this was a percent of the 97 payroll. Thank you, Mark. So in trying to understand how many people really need to get their accounts build up, how many are really in trouble. This is less than 50, but again, I used 100% as my arbitrary figure. And the worst one I found was a local at 842% of payroll as of December 97th. And we've heard from Portland at 147, and we heard from Multnomah County at 102, both of whom chose to bond and were able to bond to pay off that unfunded liability in order to take care of what they saw as a problem that would only grow larger. So the problem really is the unfunded liability that drives the employer rates as we understand it. And to ensure stable, sustainable funding, as we've said repeatedly, our little phrase, we need to catch up and keep up. We need to catch up with the unfunded liability, and we need to keep up with the accruing liability as people continue to work. We think that eliminating unfunded amounts will help the employers catch up, and that there are at least two alternatives. One is amortizing the unfunded liability through PERS with an increased employer rate. And the representatives from PERS have talked about that to some extent. They've also indicated that for some employers, they're so far behind that they'll never catch up if they only, as I understood their testimony, if they only amortize that unfunded liability by paying the increased PERS rate. So it looks like they at least need to do something in addition, and we're working together looking at issuing pension obligation bonds, which may help. But it appears that just paying a higher employer rate to PERS for some unspecified number of employers, it's not enough. There actually has to be more. In terms of reducing the risk of future underfunding so that employers can be helped in keeping up, one of the things that's very important, we think, is detecting and correcting any kind of administrative actuarial causes of the underfunding. And we've been working very closely with PERS and other stakeholders, and they are doing an actuarial audit, which will help in terms of getting the rates, making sure that they're being set as stably as possible, because nobody has a crystal ball that can 100% predict the future, but you want to try to get as close as possible. They also, in speaking with the staff, I understand that they will be recommending that there also be produced a flow chart of information or a white paper of information so that everybody can see how the money moves from account to account, which will help everybody see if there are additional problems in terms of the administrative actuarial determinations. If the actuary doesn't know how the accounts are being handled, no matter who the actuary is, their assumptions aren't going to be as precise as if they do. So that will be very good, and we really appreciate that cooperation and working with everyone. We've gotten very good cooperation from the PERS staff in terms of trying to help us figure out what the problem is and how to deal with it. We do have some concerns in terms of setting more precise employer rates in terms of the pooling solution. We're continuing to work with other stakeholders and the staff. We also are exploring if a pool is good for state agencies and a pool is good for the school agencies, might not it be better or best to have one pool for everybody that's in PERS, probably excluding the judges because they've got a different benefit structure. So we're exploring, would one pool be best? And we understand that would take legislation. Or should it be three pools, school pool, the state and community college pool, and a local government pool. So all of those things we're working through, the pros and cons, and we're getting wonderful assistance and help from the PERS staff on that. We appreciate it. We're also looking at other improvements in setting the rates, whether or not locals end up being pooled, either voluntarily or mandatorily. What else can be done to make the rates more precise, including for a pool? We want to make sure that even if we go into a pool, we don't have additional problems. And Nancy Brewer is here with me from the city of Corvallis. We'd like to add a few thoughts on that last point, if you would permit.
If I ask you, would please reintroduce yourself.
Thank you. I'm Nancy Brewer, and I'm the finance director for the city of Corvallis. just down the road a ways. I wanted to share with you a little bit of information just about one entity and what this has meant to us. For the city, for our notification from the 1997 actuarial review, we had an $11.7 million unfunded liability. That's about 73% of our annual payroll. And to us, that would mean to make that as a lump sum payment from current operating funds, we would have to quit paying employees for about three quarters of the year to make that lump sum payment to get caught up. And that's clearly not a doable solution. Police officers still need to arrest people, so you have to have people working. We have explored pension obligation bonds, and if I can maybe address some of the questions you had earlier, you cannot issue a general obligation bond with voter approval to pay off a pension liability. So a pension obligation bond is done, it's a taxable bond instead of tax exempt. So even though the city of Corvallis has an excellent credit rating, and we sold a GO bond a year ago for a 4.5% true interest cost rate, a taxable bond would be in the 7 to 8% range. What would happen if you could do a POB would be that you would hopefully get it at 7% and pay off this unfunded liability at 7%, as opposed to paying it off at 8%, which is what we're doing through a higher employer rate with PERS. And the payment does not come from outside tax sources. It would come from within the operating budget. So instead of paying PERS 13%, I would pay PERS, say, 9%, and the 4 percentage points difference would go to my debt payment. One of the problems that we have with doing a pension obligation bond is they don't work for a city of our size with only $11 million. Because they're taxable, they sell to a different investment market, and that different investment market wants to see different things in that bond issue than what we could offer. And the joke that we were having earlier this week with Steve Manton from Portland is, at $250 million, their pension obligation bond issue was on the small side, and they had some trouble marketing it because it was too small. So for us to do one at $11 million, we would see there would be no economic benefit to us. Consequently, we would see the only way we could do a pension obligation bond would be if a number of entities got together, or what would really be a delightful outcome would be if Treasury were to do it and to fully fund the PERS system, and we would simply make an annual payment to the state to make up our portion of that debt service. And part of that is, again, it's not a normal kind of bond issue, and to have 35 cities and 25 counties and however many entities involving trying to structure it, work through it, do a rating, and what is a very complex kind of bond issue would go beyond the abilities that many of us at the local level have. It would require some pretty specialized knowledge, and we think that the staff at Treasury, for example, might have that better than we would. When we go back and look at the 1997, 1998 numbers that came out from PERS in terms of our account balances, the employee accounts for the city of Corvallis increased by about 15.5% during the one-year period. The city's account balance increased 9.7% during that one-year period. I think it's pretty clear that that's what's causing us to increase an unfunded liability. When we look at what that means in terms of whole numbers, we're talking $3.76 million in 1997, difference between our employer account and our employee account, and that grew to $5.6 million 1 year later. That is, when you talk about money match, that's $5.6 million that's not available for employees to go out and retire. Based upon the present system, we would never get caught up. Even with paying higher rates, because the employee account balance is so much larger than the employer account balance, the same interest allocation does not translate to the same dollars. They get 8%, we get 8%. Their account will be larger and will be geometrically larger than our account because their balance was larger to begin with. We do applaud the PERS staff for changes that have been implemented in 1999 and the PERS board for the work that they have done, the variable account mismatch, the timing mismatches. We believe those changes will go a long way towards improving the system. But we're not real clear about whether or not that makes the system stable in the long term. again, part of it is lack of information about what all those changes will mean. I also wanted to note that when we talk about the impact of House Bill 3349, the information that we got from PERS from the 1997 valuation had our rate increase, our employer rate increase, 4.3 percentage points. That translates to about a 40% increase in our rate. Of that, 1.3 percentage points were attributable to House Bill 3349. That means 3 percentage points were attributable to our unfunded liability. So for us, 3349, while a critical issue, is not what's driving the vast majority of our increase. We have two pretty critical questions that we're continuing to follow up with PERS about and will be high on the list that we discuss with them at the regional employer group meetings that they have. And one of those is, have the changes that have been made so far been enough to cause system rate stability? And the other one is, if we were fully funded, would the changes that have been made so far cause system rate stability? And I think that the outcome of those two questions will be critical for what that means for us. I both fear, dread, and wake up in night sweats wondering what our actuary evaluation for December 31st, 1999 will mean and whether or not I will be sitting in front of my budget commission once again talking about where the money will come from for a further PERS rate increase. We are like many other cities. We do not have many places to go get additional money. And with Measure 4750, Measure 5 limits, costs like PERS increasing, we are running out of money and having to look at what the alternatives are, which include cutting services, which interestingly enough our citizens think are wonderful and they want us to provide more of, or finding additional revenue sources. And I think you all recognize that hitting our taxpayers' back pockets is not an easy question to ask of them. And so as we look at pursuing that, this is one of the areas that we're seeing a large increase in the budget that doesn't translate to additional services to our customers. And so that's where we are in terms of trying to find long-term funding stability and how we meet our obligations and commitments to employees.
The testimony. Appreciate that. Questions? Representative Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Nancy, just a question. Prior to 1997, did Corvallis have an unfunded liability?
I don't know. I believe that we did have a small, actually, let me look at it, 1993, we had an unfunded actuarial liability of $5.2 million, which was at that time 43% of our payroll.
So you've seen an acceleration since 1997?
Yes. And actually, when that number came out, our PERS rate went down that year. We were paying 8.1% in 1993. It was 8.1% of payroll was the employer's payment.
Any further questions? Maria? More?
I'd just like to repeat again that if we can be assured that we can get things on a stable, sustainable, which we all hope will happen, then again, LLC and AOC would revisit their earlier decision and position that the only way to stabilize the system going forward is to have a plan design change. They would revisit that. And so we're all working very, very hard to get those answers and make everything work. Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions? All right. Appreciate it. Thank you. Next up, Bob Livingston and members of PERS Coalition, please.
Too much money.
Morning.
Morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Bob Livingston with the Oregon State Firefighters Council. And I just briefly want to state our position in regards to why we feel that mandatory pooling is a good thing for the system in regards for local employers. What, in essence, what you will have, in my opinion, if you leave it to voluntary pooling, what you will have is certainly the people that currently have good funding stability in regards to the local entity will continue to say, hey, we can handle it, everything's going fine. And you will have adverse selection, whereas the people that have some unfunded liability and some concerns with that will certainly look at that as an option and want to do that. The position of the firefighters, as well as the rest of the PERS coalition in regards to pooling of local governments, is, as I'd like to reiterate what I believe Mr. Voitko did an excellent job of explaining, is that if there is unfunded liabilities that an entity currently has, that does not automatically go into the pool. In fact, those local employers would still be on the record for making sure that that unfunded liability is covered by the local entity and not the entire pool. That is our position on that. Now, as far as I will just briefly close in why I believe mandatory pooling is a good thing is just by the absence of the fact that it's interesting, as we look into the PERS issue here in the interim, I don't see anybody from the school districts or from the state employees saying that pooling has been a detrimental thing or a bad thing. And also, I believe that Mark Johnson has reiterated time and time again, from an actuarial standpoint, when he uses that to try to calculate what employer rate should be, it makes sense to even a person like me that doesn't understand statistics at the level that Mark does, that when you have a larger pool of people to do an actuarial assessment and try to determine what an experience ratio is, you're going to be a lot better to predict current and future liabilities. Whereas if you're a small employee and you may only have 5 or 6 employees, it's real difficult for Mark to really try to do an assessment on what their projection should be. So in essence, pooling certainly has stabilized rates for state employee agencies as well as for school employers, and we have no reason to believe that it won't do the same for local governments.
Thank you, Bob. Questions? Thanks.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Pat West with Oregon State Firefighters. Just a couple of things we've talked about here today that besides the pooling. The one thing I'll say, had the pooling been in effect since the last time it was discussed, approximately 1990, the rates across the board, even including the taxation issue, would have been less than 1% for all local employers. So the local employers that are currently talking about being in situations of having over 100% of payroll would not have that situation had pooling been in effect at that time. So some of the horror stories that we're hearing, and they're horrible. I mean, these local entities have a really big problem, wouldn't have happened. Then the other issues that we've been talking about today that I agree help with the unfunded liability, which is employer variable, is one. We have said on the record that we were in favor of employer variable, but that we felt that the employer's money should be put into the variable first before they got credited the interest at the variable rate. And what the PERS board did was that they went retro back to January 1 of 99. They gave them credit for the variable rate for last year without the money being in the variable account. We were opposed to that. We're still opposed to that. It's already been done, but you will most likely be seeing that we'll be filing a lawsuit. We're just serving notice that it was inappropriate. And to try and put it in perspective, if you were to do the reverse, which is to say to employees, how about if we go ahead and let you take all your money that was in the variable, that was in the fixed account, and we're just going to give you credit for as if it had been in the variable. We'll give you the 27% instead of the 18. I think the employees would say, I like that. That's a good idea. I would like to do that. Well, that's what they did with employers. There's no difference. Obviously, we can't do it as employees in retrospect, move our money to the variable after it's already earned the money. So we were opposed to doing that, but not the concept of employer variable. And we also have some concerns over the way that the reserve accounts are being dealt with, especially since the Tier 1 employees are phasing out, meaning that Tier 1 is going away, and the reserve accounts need, they need to have an orderly process of how they're going to deal with the reserve accounts and how they dwindle down.
Very good. Thank you. Any questions for Pat? Yes, Representative Witt.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This would be for either of you gentlemen. In terms of your support for mandatory polling, what reason would a local government entity, a city, a county, a special district, why would they want to be forced into mandatory polling if they are in sound actuarial condition, in fact, may have significant surpluses? And if they were required to mandatory polling, what do they tell their constituents and taxpayers in their district when they've been prudent in terms of managing their resources to meet these unfunded liabilities? What incentive would they have to support this? And what fairness is there inherent in this?
Chairman Wilson, Representative Witt, I think the answer to that is almost when you look back over the last, some of the descriptions that were given of how 5 years ago there was employers that had no unfunded liability. Everything was rosy. They thought that they were paid up. But what happened was they had some traumatic system problem, meaning that they had a whole bunch of people go out on disability, and a whole bunch, if you only have 10 employees, can be one or two. So that what happens then is their rate was based on nobody ever going out on disability because they'd never had one before, and all of a sudden they do not have enough money in their fund to pay for the disability. Well, their rate then goes, it skyrockets. Without pooling, they have that eventuality can be there for any employer, and the smaller the employer is, the more likely that it's going to happen.
Mr. Chairman, if I can follow.
Follow up.
Well, let's not just talk about small employers. I mean, I'm looking here at City of Beaverton, and I'm showing that they have as of 12/31/97, they had an $11 million surplus. I mean, what incentive would the City of Beaverton, as an example, what incentive would they have to want to be into a pooled arrangement?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Witt, I don't know Beaverton's exact situation, but I would assume that they had an unfunded liability prior to 95 also. So I don't know if it was their own experience rating that created the unfunded liability or whether they had been, in effect, doing a mortgage or they came into the system with an unfunded liability. It does make a difference. Because pooling from this day forward, the rate will be stable. It will not be going up to 17, 18, 19, 20%.
No, they're showing a surplus.
Okay.
$11 million surplus.
Excuse me. As Peirce described it, they would have a reduced rate until that surplus was used up. So the advantage to them for their prudent money would be that they would pay a lower rate than the established rate until that surplus was used up, and then the rate would be the system rate.
Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
Isn't there an issue, though, here of employer responsibility in terms of how they manage these issues? Through pooling, what you're doing is you're making every employer dependent upon decisions that are made by other employers who are in the pool. But it would look to me, from looking at some of this information, that some local government employers have been more responsible in terms of making sure that they've met unfunded liability. By pooling, you eliminate that local responsibility, don't you?
I believe that's correct, Mr. Chairman.
So it's correct that you eliminate the local responsibility?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Witt, I believe that's true. They would get a stabilized rate. They would lose the responsibility of running the system or figuring out how to fund the dollars. I'm not saying that correctly. But they would also have the added benefit of not having the liability of having a huge experience rating problem that makes their rates go skyrocketing. Because even those that have a excess of funds in the system right now could have a problem that would make those funds go away, having not been pooled.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative Witt, if I could maybe add to that too, let's use your example of the city of Beaverton. Right now, certainly we applaud them for being able to manage their money and to have a surplus, and certainly that may reflect, one, it may reflect the demographics of their workforce. They may have a very young workforce, or it may be a very desirable place to live. But what we're trying to do within this system is I think, if what you really need to look at is you need to look at a long-term retirement system, which is what PERS is. So here, a window of opportunity, if you will. They may have a surplus here in the short term, but what we're trying to do is find long-term solutions. And what we're saying is that by pooling of local governments, both the ones that have surplus and an unfunded liability, in effect what you do is you make it easier for Mark Johnson, when he does an actuarial assumption, to get closer to where you are. Because let's just use the city of Beaverton as an example. 25 years from now, let's say it's a very desirable place to live. They don't have a lot of turnover. A lot of people don't move to other places. Now all of a sudden they have a bunch of people go out. Their experience may not be reflective of what really is going on. And so what we're trying to say is that by pooling, you have a bigger pool, and what it does is it stabilizes your rates. And I think Mark Johnson would come up here and say that it may not necessarily decrease the rates, but what it's going to do, as Pat referenced, is you won't see a fluctuation of 1 year from 12 to 17 back down to 11. It's a stabilization process, and it's for a long-term fix, and that's why we would support it.
So as an example, in a situation like Beaverton is now, you might tell them and their taxpayers to, at this point, sacrifice for the good of the system then, in general.
Mr. Chair, I think you could probably say that. And then the other thing is the sacrifice that maybe they're making. I'm not sure Mark would have to run the numbers to see if there actually was going to be a slight increase or a decrease in their rates. But over time, if I was a member of the Beaverton Council, I would say that this is a long-term retirement plan for our employees, just like any other. And a short-term adjustment is going to give us long-term stability, which is better for all of us as taxpayers.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gentlemen, isn't there an issue also there of local accountability and local control? I mean, mandatory means you must. So we're going to dictate to all of these entities that you must join this pool, even though your elected officials may believe that in your particular entity, that is not in the best interest of your taxpayers or your constituents.
And Mr.
Aren't you concerned about this issue of taking away local control and local responsibility in terms of that decision-making?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Witt, I'll speak for myself. As far as the issue of local control, I think that it's been shown that what has happened is not just small jurisdictions, but it's more pervasive. But some of the larger jurisdictions have a huge unfunded liability also. They didn't think that they were going to have one, 5 years ago or 10 years ago. But because of the system or the smallness of their group, that they didn't even understand that potential existed. And I think that for the local entities, what they give up with pooling, they gain back in stability for their citizens. And I guess that's my answer. The fact is that some of these small jurisdictions may end up having to lay off all the firefighters in their jurisdiction because they had local control. If they don't have enough money to pay the unfunded liability of the retirement system, because they maintained local control, then I think that in itself creates a problem.
Mr. Chairman, follow up. Isn't the more fundamental question here is to should the legislature mandate them to make one decision, in other words, join the pool, or should we let locally elected officials make that decision based upon their judgment and based upon what they believe is best for their constituents? I mean, that's the issue here, that I'm trying to get at. Should the legislature mandate that, or should we let the local elected officials make what they believe is the best decision for their constituents?
Mr. Chairman, I think when the local jurisdictions join PERS, they, in effect, have already given up a good percentage of their local control over the system, over their retirement. But probably more important, the issue of pooling is going to be adversely impacted if it's voluntary. So the decision, I think, is either you pool and it's and everyone is in for the greater good of all, or you don't pool because what will happen is you're only going to have the people when they get in trouble pool.
Thank you. Yes, Paul.
Yeah, just an observation. I don't think that's true. And in fact, you know, you've made the point that you may have a surplus and be okay right now, but by pooling will eliminate some volatility. So I think there's a reason and an argument there for some local entities to decide, yeah, that makes sense because that's going to eliminate some volatility in the future. So, but you know, in fact, you've made that argument, and I think these people are going to operate rationally and reasonably, and they're going to make a decision. Either that argument bears weight and makes sense, or it doesn't. So I don't agree with the conclusion that only people that have the unfunded liability are in the dire straits are going to join the pool. However, the question becomes is, should we eliminate the responsibility and authority of local governments to make a voluntary decision as opposed to an involuntary decision?
Thank you.
Brian DeLeish, representing the Oregon Nurses Association, the Oregon Council of Police Associations, Association of Corrections Employees, and Federation of Parole and Probation Officers. Without going too deep in, I've listened, set aside and listened to the pooling argument. The only additional comment without me getting into this dialogue on pooling is that, in fact, legislature has at one point in the past gone down the path of mandating and when they did pooling of schools. So they have taken that action in the past, whether it's the right action or the wrong action for some new group, obviously, is up for debate. But the legislature has already done that. And if the point is that you've taken away local control, the legislature has already done that one time, at least from the employers with school districts. So not a path that hasn't already been walked at least once. So, very briefly, I just have a couple of comments. And actually, Pat touched upon a couple of things that I was going to talk about. Was, you know, historically on 722 that the issue of the variable was there, and that my clients, along with the rest of the coalition, did not have a problem with a variable, an employer and a variable. I mean, we've made that very clear. The problem we had with 722 was the third tier, and that alone. We didn't have a problem with the bonding piece there. But recent actions by the PERS board have led us, as Pat had indicated, to the situation where we are put in a position of having to potentially litigate for the recovery of what we believe is damages to the employees by that action. We didn't want anybody to be surprised and read in the newspaper that suit had been filed. We are hopeful on both the gain loss reserve and on the variable issue that those issues, through continued dialogue with the PERS staff, the PERS board, and all other elements, that can be worked out short of litigation. But because the clock is running, we have 60 days from the action, the February 8th action, to file that suit. We wanted to let you know that you may read in the newspaper that there has been suits filed, and not to be surprised by that action. It's the only way that we can, in fact, have the page saver in the legal process if that's necessary to occur. The one additional thing that I will say very briefly is that after a series of meetings that we have had both with staff and with the PERS board, we are in fact hopeful that there'll be resolution on these two issues that's satisfactory. Not that it's guaranteed, but I want to commend the PERS staff for meeting with us, exploring some possibilities, continuing that dialogue, and we are hopeful that that will go forward in the future and it will not be an issue that escalates and all of a sudden is a major legal issue rather than something that reasonable minds can work out.
All right, thanks, Brian. Any questions? All right, gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. Okay, at this point, we'll be happy to take any additional testimony or comments. from the audience today? Anyone care to speak to the issues? All right, we can have our PERS folks back up again, please. Wanted to ask a question about something that our speaker from Corvallis mentioned a few moments ago about, if I followed that correctly, about the aspect of pooling for purposes of bonding. And I hope I followed that correctly a few moments ago. Do you have any comments on that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I have been involved in the capital markets a long time, and I have to agree wholeheartedly with the comments of the person from Corvallis. Small bond issues are not of interest to the capital market, number one. Number two is there are exceptions and there are credit qualities all over the lot with respect to local governments, but in general, stronger credits get lower interest rates. And so I think the issue, the issues that she raised are on the money. The larger the bond issue can be, which is intimately tied with how large the pool of local employers are if we decide to go ahead with pooling and if they join, as well as what imprimatur, credit rating, credit backing, if you will, is carried behind the bond, whether it's that pool itself and its tax-raising capability or whether the state chooses, which is not in our purview, obviously, to put its credit rating behind that bond. That will make a difference in terms of the interest rate that's received in the market and the interest in the bond.
Thank you, Representative Hansen.
In that same area, is there any technical changes that we could make to guarantee that a large pooled bond sale could be put out of the market so it was interest-free? Or not interest-free, but so it was a tax-free issuance instead of taxable?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, that's a technical question that goes back to what are the requirements for a tax-free bond, and I'd have to pause on that question, and we have to take a look at the bond itself, and I don't think I can give you an answer off the cuff for that.
Other questions?
Representative Winters. There was a comment made about the Treasury or working with the Treasury's Department on the possibility of bonding and loans. Have you explored that or will you explore that avenue?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winters, we've had some discussions with Treasury to this point and talked with Gary Brubaker, the Deputy Treasurer, just the other day, and he's very interested in continuing to work on this issue. But we're really at the beginning phases of it. There's a lot more work that needs to be done. But they're committed to working with us, too.
Are they really excited or kind of lukewarm?
I'd say that they're more on the excited side than lukewarm. Yeah.
Could you keep us posted on that? I would appreciate a regular conversation on that.
Mr. Chairman, can I make one additional comment with respect to Treasury's involvement for Representative Winters? And that is there are three things for sure that I'm interested in having them help us with. And those three issues are, first of all, they have experience in raising money in the public marketplace, which our agency generally doesn't. The second thing is the issue that I mentioned earlier about the state's credit rating. They would obviously have to be intimately involved in whether or not the legislature was and the administration was interested in doing that. And the third thing is, and I don't know the feasibility of this, in terms of making the bond larger, more marketable, and therefore potentially carrying a low interest rate, whether it's even possible to package other borrowing needs of the state into a single bond that makes it more marketable rather than less. I know in the private sector there are examples of corporate bonds that are floated for multiple purposes, and those are stated. Largely in the municipal market, there's usually a single purpose, dormitories for state universities or whatever. But it's possible that the state has other borrowing needs and all the other agreements are in place about pooling and how it should be done and whose credit rate it should carry, that there's a possibility that should be explored of a package borrowing.
Obviously, we can't know the future, but our guest from Corvallis also raised a question that interested me, and that is, if there were no unfunded liabilities anywhere, would the tweaks to the system, the current rates, the actuarial situation, can it be seen that that these changes and situations that have been brought forward here would lead to stability?
Mark, do you want to handle that?
Yes. One way to view an employer's unfunded liability is essentially a mortgage. And there is in place, and there has been ever since we've been doing the valuation since the mid-70s, an amortization of an unfunded liability so that there is, you know, a reasonable expectation that it will be amortized at some point in time. For most employers with an unfunded liability, I think we need to view it as a mechanism for funding all of the benefits that expect to be paid, not necessarily a problem with a capital T any more than the fact that I have a mortgage on my house. I don't necessarily view that as a problem with a capital T. Now, having said that, there are a few employers where there is a significant problem, which we've talked about before. In addition to that, because an employer has an unfunded liability, it's not in itself a problem. It's a mechanism for trying to get enough money, and we've funded over 30 years, for example. I think if there were no unfunded liability, obviously we'd have more stability. What's left is the average cost of benefits that accrue every year. That's a very stable number called normal cost rate. Unless there are changes in benefits or changes in assumptions or dramatic changes in demographics, which there are not systems this size with most employers, that's going to be very stable. The problem that we see, and one of the reasons that we've advocated pooling for the local employers for a number of years, is that 70% of the employers have less than 25 employees. And over half of the employers have less than 10 employees. Well, it's very hard to predict what's going to happen. And in fact, we had testimony in one of the ad hoc committee meetings from a representative from the city of Huntington. Had one disability. Unfortunately, they only had a few actives, and one disability shot their rate sky high. I can't predict. Now, I am making predictions of probabilities, but you know, if you have five people, and the chance of somebody becoming disabled is a few basis points. You know, if nobody becomes disabled, you've got a gain. If one person becomes disabled, you've got a terrible loss. And there's just no other way around it. So pooling, in a sense, in my mind, from an actuarial standpoint, the main benefit of pooling is stability, particularly for the smaller employers. Now, I would also mention Beaverton. I happen to know a little bit about it. The reason that Beaverton is in such good shape is because they joined the system in 1980 with no past service. They had a private retirement system in which they either kept or cashed people out. So they don't have 30-year retirees with huge money match accounts. In the last valuation, the longest tenure of any employee in Beaverton would have been 17 years. So, as we've gone through and talked to these employers with problems, we didn't talk to Beaverton, they don't have a problem, but there's a situation at each of these large employers that describes where they are. There's no hidden agenda in these numbers. There usually is a decent explanation of how an employer got to a certain situation. So in terms of pooling, I think if we do our job, if it turns out that it's voluntary, and we do our job on educating employers on the advantages and disadvantages, I would be hopeful that we would get a large number of employers wanting to join the pool, even if they do have a surplus. Because I think the story is that if they have a surplus, they're not sharing that surplus with anyone else. They're getting full credit for that surplus. What they're sharing is the future gains and losses. So, for example, you've got a small employer that's built up a surplus. We're saying you're going to get credit for that surplus, but wouldn't you rather pool the chance that you're going to have one disability that's going to kill you next year? And that's, I think, the issue. And we gave some examples at the ad hoc committee meeting about what one disability could potentially do to an employer with 5 or 10 employees, and it's not a pretty sight. So, I mean, those are the issues that I think if we educate employers on, hopefully we'll get informed decisions that will be beneficial to the pool. And obviously, there will still be some anti-selection. I love the idea about making the meetings mandatory. That was a great idea. Even if you don't join the pool, at least you've got to be there to hear a story. Maybe we can work with that somehow.
All right. Thank you for the questions. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gentlemen, would mandatory polling potentially create a ballot measure 30 problem of unfunded mandates? Has that been looked into?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, our attorneys say that they've looked into it and it would not.
It would not, in your attorney's opinion.
And I apologize, but that's about the extent of my knowledge. That's right.
Thank you for the questions. All right. Thanks very much. Anyone else care to testify on this issue today? If not, we'll go ahead and stand in recess until 1:15. We do have a schedule here this afternoon, 1:15 update on the Oregon State Fair Task Force, 2 o'clock building codes, and 2:15 building codes, Senate Bill 512 implementation.
You're with Middleman and Robertson.